supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows for you cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about gooseberries, an uncommon plant that should be a fruit in everyone's garden, says our fruiting expert, Lee Reich. We're also going to interview a young man who has created a raised bed garden on wheels designed for school children, people who are differently abled and have to garden from wheelchairs, and people like me who are just tired as heck of trying to bend over in the garden. That's a lot to get done. So we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, thanks for being had, Michael. Where are you?
I'm in Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Over in the Garden State. What can we do for you, Michael?
I've been looking into a raised flower bed. Actually, a garden. And I've seen on the internet some people creating these raised beds using cinder blocks in kind of an urban setting. I don't want to go quite that urban with cinder blocks, but I was considering using landscaping block. But the question I have is, to build this bed out of landscaping block, I'd have to use an adhesive to attach the blocks together so it would stay stable. And I was curious how I would do that without having maybe adhesive leaching into the garden, or if that's not even a good idea to even go this route. I'm not sure.
I think pavers are the new wave of raised bed framing. I think you are exactly right in your idea. Cinder blocks, God bless them, they've been around since the earliest days of Organic Gardening magazine, and people paint them all sorts of bright colors, and they turn them on their sides, and they use the holes to put flowers in, but they're god-awful ugly no matter how you do them.
Right.
And pavers are great, and the good news is that if you buy pavers that are flat and rectangular, you don't need to adhere them. All you do is stack them up like Legos. I realize they don't have the things to stick into each other, but I've seen many garden walls made of pavers that are not grouted or held together in any way. So just a foot high raised bed, 4x8, that's going to hold together really well. And
what about going a little higher than a foot, more like 2 or 3 feet high?
Oh, you're going for the sky, so you don't want to bend over anymore either.
Well, I've got the zoysia grass around my lawn, and it's super invasive. The rhizomes, I believe they're called, they reach up and get on top of everything and seem to want to just grow anywhere. So
that,
I figured
that is one of the big advantages of raised beds. I'm very familiar with zoysia grass. I grew up with it. Now, what you have to do is you're thinking backwards. You're only going to need a foot of height because you're cutting your zoysia grass at about 2 inches, I hope. Zoysia is cut lower than a cool season grass. But what you want to do is drive strong edging into the ground around the outside of your blocks. Now, that's not only going to stop the zoysia from creeping underneath, but it's also going to stabilize that first level of blocks. You'll actually make a little matting within a frame by having that nice liner outside to prevent the zoysia grass from moving forward. You'll have a great stabilizer, and if you pick the colors right, it'll look fabulous.
Okay.
And the zoysia will not be able to climb a brick wall. Zoysia is an amazing grass at moving laterally, but it has not yet learned how to make little siege towers out of itself and climb walls.
Right. I guess my concern was it going under as well and becoming part of the garden bed eventually.
Well, make sure you pull up all the zoysia. You know, you'll remove it with a sod cutting tool and then put down that layer of cardboard on the bottom. And then with that and the edging and the pavers themselves, I don't think you're going to have any issues.
Okay. And even building a box 2 to 3 feet high, with the amount of pressure that the soil would create on the interior, you still don't think something like an adhesive of any kind to hold the black together as needed?
Well, I don't think it's necessary. Again, unless you're gardening for a differently abled situation, why are you building so high?
I guess just for more aesthetics. I thought it would look kind of nice and create a barrier around where our patio is, where I want to put the garden.
Why don't you meet in the middle, make it about 2 feet high, and if you find that you have problems, you can always go back and mortar them.
Sounds great, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lauren, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing fine, Lauren. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
And where is Lauren well?
Downingtown, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia.
Yep.
All right, what can we do for Lauren?
We're having some issues with growing grass in our yard. So our home, just kind of a backstory, is its new construction was built last year. So they put down just like the regular contractor seed. So it grew in last summer, and it grew high, but it grew in really thin and really patchy. And then it ended up getting, I think, cut too short, and a lot of it burned and died.
Well, Lauren, did the contractor seed the lawn in the spring?
I believe so, yeah. The house was finished around March.
Yeah, so that grass was probably doomed no matter how much abuse it got afterwards.
Got it. So this spring, we've spent quite a bit of time and money trying to build this into somewhat of a functional lawn. And so we've tried several things. We've tried the Scott's Easy Seed and Turf Builder, Patchmaster.
But you didn't try the right thing, which was to sow the seed at the correct time of year. Now, admittedly, in the springtime, garden centers and home stores are lousy with grass seed, cool season grass seed, bluegrass and fescue, and it's almost all doomed.
Oh.
The cool season grasses, the kind I expect you've been trying to grow, the bluegrass and the fescue, they come from Ireland, Scotland, Wales, England. They don't like the summer heat. Plus, the soil is generally too cool to germinate them in the spring. So they lay there for a long time, and then these thin, wispy blades of grass get burned up by the summer heat. Mm-hmm. Now, for once in my life, you're a caller with perfect timing.
Oh, great.
Because you have to do it again, but this time you're going to do it, and it's going to be like the miracle of Fatima. You're going to turn around and you're going to go, why didn't anybody tell us this before? So what you want to do is around the 1st of August, you want to just tear up all that junk you got out front. Rake away as much of the old green as you can. Don't worry about it. Don't fuss over it. Mm-hmm. Level the soil. And then have a nice load of clean black topsoil or even better yard waste compost delivered. And spread that as thick as you can over top of the area you want to seed.
Okay.
And then very important is to level the surface. This is the step that people miss. But the idea to keep the grass healthy over time, you need to cut it at a uniform height. And you can't do that if you started out with land that looked like a roller coaster track.
Right.
So you want to level it out, and then you want to get a nice named variety of seed.
Sure.
Because you want to be able to buy this same seed again in the future to do
right.
repairs with. And then the magic date is August 15th. Really, as soon as the summer heat stress is over, you just sow this seed in your nice new seed bed. You don't smother it with straw or any other nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You give it the gentlest mist watering you can twice a day for the first 5 days. The grass will be up and growing, and then the great deception will begin. Because at the end of August, even though we think of it as the last of summer, really the days have gotten significantly shorter. The nights are getting cooler. From now through winter, through early spring, the grass will think it's back in Ireland. It'll be this moderate kind of climate. So by the time that the summer heat arrives, which is the worst enemy of the grasses in our region, your lawn will be almost a year old.
Right.
It'll have a deep root system. Things you'll do to keep it good after it establishes is you'll back off on the watering. And in the future, I mean, this year people haven't had to water at all,
know,
because we've had so much rain. But if we get a dry spell and you do have to water, you want to water deeply once a week in the morning for several hours, just once a week, no short sprinkles or anything like that. You want to cut with a sharp blade, a super sharp blade, at 3 inches high. That's when you're done cutting.
Got it.
And leave the clippings on the lawn. If you do those things, people will be coming up to you and asking what your lawn care secret. But there's no way that you could have succeeded with the timing you've been following. You have been misled.
Got it.
And it's counterintuitive to put a lawn in the late summer, in the early fall, but our lawn care professional, Nick Christians from Iowa State University, has said that if that's all you do, if you install it between August 15th and September 15th, it'll be bulletproof.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck. Time is finally on your side.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be answering your garden questions live and in person during a very special meet and greet on Saturday, August 2nd, beginning around 4 o'clock, as part of the 10th annual Iron Hill Twilight Bike Race and Street Festival in downtown Westchester, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with a young man who has designed a raised bed garden on wheels, the wild world of the gooseberry, and of course, lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. Later in the show, we are going to enter the wild world of the gooseberry, an underutilized fruit that you can grow in spots that don't get full sun, and that comes in a variety of flavors and colors. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our very special guest, Justin Connell, who is the CEO and founder of LifeCycleGarden.org and the inventor of one of the most unique container gardens I've ever seen and that is currently sitting out on my patio. Justin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Well, you came to me, so to speak, at an opportune time for me. I think this is probably the first time I'll tell the listeners about it, but in early May, I had a very serious surgery of my shoulder. I had a complete tear of my rotator cuff and was faced pretty much with a season without gardening. Now, I wound up hiring our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, to help me out. But when I saw an email about your new device, I decided this may be just what I'm looking for, especially if the surgery doesn't work. For many years, as you know, gardeners are getting older. There's a lot of people with physical impairment that wish to garden. And what I've been telling them for years is tabletop gardening. Arrange a bunch of containers up on top of a picnic table or a real sturdy table so that everything is right at arm's length, so to speak, right at the right height for standing or wheelchair. But you did me one better.
This is true, yeah. The Garden on Wheels has a lot of different features that make it really perfect for really anyone who wants to garden. And that was kind of my inspiration, was to make it a garden product that anyone could use, you know, regardless of physical limitations or space limitations.
It really grows a lot of stuff in a very small place, which is like the credo of the great John Jevons. His line was grow twice as much in half the space. And you really can do that. So let's try to describe it. It's a big tub that I went out and actually measured yesterday. I generally don't do things this seriously, but it's 3 feet long. It's a little under 2 feet wide. It's a good foot deep. And on one end, it's on wheels. And on the other end, it's on adjustable legs. You can really moderate the height, but one of the things it seems you were very careful to do is make sure this could be adjusted to standard wheelchair heights.
Yeah, definitely. So what we have is a garden that's on wheels with a wheelbarrow design, which makes it light and easy to move, which allows you to maximize both your sunlight and your space. So if you have a patio or balcony with sunlight in one area in the morning and a different area in the afternoon, you can follow the sunlight with your garden. And then you can also increase your growing season by over 2 months because you can start your seeds indoors and then bring those, you know, that garden outside in the warm parts of the day and then back in at night or in the morning to save it from the frost. And then secondly, of course, we have those adjustable legs that you were talking about, and they adjust from 30 inches to 37 inches, which allows you to choose whether to sit or stand. And like you said, it is wheelchair accessible. And I thought the adjustable height feature was really important because, you know, a lot of different people have different needs. So if I were to make one, let's say, at standing height, then the people who wanted to be able to sit down and garden because that's more comfortable for them, they'd be left out. So I wanted to make sure it was adaptable to everyone. And then lastly, we have an integrated watering can that's underneath the drain of the top of the garden. So when you pull the plug, the water will drain into that watering can, and that water is nutrient rich. So you're basically recycling and reusing nutrient rich water back into the garden, which not only saves water, but also provides more nutrients to the soil.
So you're all about water conservation. On the East Coast, we're about trying not to drown this season. So my plug has been out since I set this thing up on my patio. And the super cool thing is in between the wheels, there is like a plastic holder. And in the center of the holder is a uniquely shaped watering can so that when we have a heavy rain, the water from the bed drains down into the lower pan and then goes right into the watering can. So you can use it to water your other containers, or 5 days later, you can use it to rewater that container. But you're right, because if you're gardening the way my people do, which is with a high amount of organic content, even in a raised bed container system like this, there's a lot of nutrients in that water. That's almost compost tea.
Yeah, it really is. And that was one of the cool things when we, you know, first were inventing this product, was trying to reuse that water, because we realized so much of that water goes to waste. And there's so many products on the market currently that are raised bed container garden systems that allow the water to drain right onto your patio or balcony. And not only does that not look good because it's brown, murky water running around on your patio, but it also could be reused and recycled. So, you know, we figured why not get the best of both worlds.
Now, you designed this, and you're a punk kid, is my understanding. You're only in your low 20s?
Yeah, you know, I was actually a sophomore playing college basketball when I suffered a pretty serious injury where I cracked a vertebrae in my back. And during that time, I had to move home with my family and wear a back brace and take a semester off of school to do the rehab process. And, you know, I had this big, gnarly back brace on. And my mom, who's a very avid gardener, in Northern California, you know, she tried to have me help her in the garden, and I couldn't bend over and kneel down. And it kind of inspired me to come up with a solution. So I started building wooden raised beds in my garage, and I started selling them very successfully to assisted living homes. And I realized that there was a market for this product. So I actually tried out for Shark Tank.
Ah, really?
Yeah, I slept on a street corner in LA with like 1,000 other people, made it to the second round of auditions, and then they basically told me that I wasn't ready, I didn't have a mass producible product, and that I basically just, you know, wasn't prepared to be on the show yet. So, you know, I went home and I just kept, you know, plugging away on these things, and I eventually met a couple of venture capitalists who I was able to convince to fund me with my first stage of financing.
So you went out and found your own sharks, which are somewhat plentiful, let's face it, off the coast of California. For our listeners who only watch PBS, Shark Tank is a show where would-be inventors display their products to a group of venture capitalists and try to see which one will be picked and financed to produce their invention. But right now, as I said, we filled it up. Boy, I tell you, it holds a lot of soil. That was, I think we filled it up with like 6 big bags of soil-free mix, 16 quarts each, a whole bunch of perlite, because I really like those things light, and a couple of bags worth of compost. And I still didn't fill it all the way up to the top. We just ran out of mix.
And yeah, you know, there's 5.25 cubic feet of garden space in the garden, and we did that specifically because we wanted to allow people to be able to, you know, kind of almost be homesteaders and be able to grow enough produce at your house to be able to reduce your grocery bill and be able to eat those fresh, you know, right off the vine tomatoes as opposed to going to the store and buying the ones that just don't taste as good.
Well, we, because it was early in the season when we first got it, I filled the entire center with cutting lettuces, and which we were overwhelmed with in a situation like this. It grew very fast. And I lined the edges with nasturtiums so that they can trail down over the side. Like you said, it's like 3 feet off the ground, so I figured I would make use of that space.
Yeah.
There's so many nice features about it. And as you said, a lot of people don't have a lot of sun. They have a patio or something. They've been struggling with containers. And sometimes the sun changes during the day, and your thing can be wheeled to follow the sun. And if everything is on one level, as you said, you could even wheel it in and out of a garage or a house during cold nights.
Absolutely, especially in the Midwest. I've had customers who've really sworn by the product because they've had, you know, a frost come in after a few weeks of heat, and then, you know, all their plants die. So I've had some customers buy the garden on wheels specifically for that reason, so that they can, you know, bring it in the house when they know, or in the garage when they know that the frost's going to come in.
Yeah. Now you have two names, right? Life Cycle Gardens is the name of your company.
Yeah, that's our brand name, Life Cycle Gardens. We have a website, lifecyclegardens.com, and make sure that you type in gardens with an S. It's plural, lifecyclegardens.com. And then our product is called the Garden on Wheels. And we actually just came out with the Garden on Wheels Junior as well.
Oh, really?
They're both available on my website.
Okay.
And we actually recently received we were issued a patent on the Garden on Wheels, the original version, the one that you've been talking about so far on the show.
Now, you have also a special program for schools who want to utilize this resource?
Yeah. So one thing that I really strongly believe in is teaching children about their food source at an early age and trying to kind of teach them about not only how do you grow food, but how do you be sustainable? Because I think the future of the world is going to be people needing to grow their own foods. And especially in, you know, the world that we live in right now with GMOs being so prevalent and not really knowing what you're eating, I think that teaching kids how to be sustainable and grow their own food is very important. So I started a program called 100 Gardens for 100 Schools. And if you were to go onto Indiegogo or even onto YouTube and you type in Life Cycle Gardens or 100 Gardens for 100 Schools, you'll see the video that I made. And basically what I'm doing is I'm raising funds so that I can cover my cost to build and ship these products to elementary schools across the country. And I'm trying to basically give them away for free with the help of some funding from Americans who want to help children throughout the country be able to have garden programs in schools. One of the big things that is great about our product is that a school, for instance, in Philadelphia that's in an urban jungle where there really is no plot of land in their schoolyard to actually grow on, the Garden on Wheels allows you to have a garden at your school despite those circumstances.
And you can roll it inside and lock it up at night.
Absolutely. You can go to my website, www.lifecyclegardens.com, and you can go ahead and contact us. And that email goes directly to me, and I'd be more than happy to work with you to make sure that your school and your children are able to get a garden at a low cost.
All right. Justin Connell is the inventor of the Garden on Wheels, W-H-E-E-L-Z, you fancy guy, which is a really nice portable container raised bed on wheels. It's a very clever design, Justin.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and for having me on the show today.
It's been our pleasure. Justin Connell is the CEO and founder of Life Cycle Gardens, and you'll find out more about them at lifecyclegardens.com. Justin, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks. Have a good one.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Patrick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
And where is Patrick doing well?
We are doing well in Broomall, Pennsylvania.
And what can we do for you?
I have read your existing article on bat houses and have done other research online. And I'm willing to concede that it's not the miracle cure for mosquitoes. But what I really wanted to understand is there still a net benefit of having one from like an ecological perspective?
So you read my heartbreaking article, which broke my heart, as well as everybody else, that the story about bats eating mosquitoes at night is mostly a myth, mostly an extrapolation of one little laboratory experiment that was done many years ago, and that bats are mostly eating insects that are fairly big and are flying around at night. So we're talking some of the worst garden offenders. We're talking about these night-flying scarab beetles that they do the second shift when the Japanese beetles kick off work and go for a beer at 5 o'clock. They're eating all these night-flying moths that lay the eggs that turn into such destructive garden caterpillars. With the white-nose syndrome affecting bats all up and down the East Coast, maybe even across the country, this terrible disease afflicting them, there's a great fear of a wave of pestilence, a biblical wave, should we lose these bats. You know, there's millions, billions of bats flying around every summer when they're healthy, and they're consuming enormous amounts of insects, and some huge amount, 90%. Are agricultural pests. The problem with the bat houses is most of the ones I've seen are too small. You know, a little box that holds a couple of bats won't be used. These are social creatures that like to live by the hundreds. The best bat houses, in terms of the last research I saw, the design was kind of an imitation belfry. Like when they'd knock down an old house and bats would have been living in the attic and in the chambers there. Well, the best bat houses are actually fake tops of houses up on long stilts. Because when you have a bat house, you also have to have a big clearance below it. Weirdly, when bats come out of a bat house, they free fall. They drop down for like 6 or 10 feet and then they start flying. So there has to be this open bottom. They have to be angled right. They have to be facing the sun in a specific direction and have enough have enough room inside for the bats to move around to adjust their temperature.
One of the ones I found online, it says it holds 185 bats, but they still do recommend getting two of these cans. They're not it's not a can. It just it's definitely cylindrical in shape and it has the plywood, the roughed up plywood in the underside.
I don't see a lot of bat boxes that I like, but you say a single one can hold almost 200 bats.
Yeah,
And they're modular. That means you could connect two of them or something like that?
So they're showing it on a 6x6 post. They're saying you can mount up to 8 bat cans on one post.
Wow.
I'm willing to go at least get 2 of them if it would help. I mean, we do have a lot of other flying insects. We live kind of at the start of a creek.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely see bats flying around at night. And I'd love
God
for them
bless
to,
you.
I'd love for them to live a little closer.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if these things are big, they're open at the bottom, they're
yep.
high up in the air, I would certainly give it a try. And the nice thing about this is bats and birds are not exclusive. I would also look into putting up a couple of big martin houses and creating nesting areas for swallows.
Because oh, okay.
if my memory serves me well, those are the two biggest mosquito-eating birds. When it comes to mosquito eaters, the best is the dragonfly.
Right.
But there are certainly things you can do to put up nesting boxes and like a big martin house that would have a real big impact on the mosquitoes. And then you got birds, you got your bats, you got everything.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right, good luck, man.
All right, thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind lawn owners with cool season grasses like fescue and bluegrass that this is the time to not feed your lawn. Summer feedings can kill these popular northern grasses. Ah, but if you have a warm season grass like Zoysia, St. Augustine, Bermuda, or Centipede, summer is the time for gentle feedings. And that's no matter where you live. You always feed by the type of grass, not by your zip code. But don't go looking for all the details under lawn care in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we're coming right back at you with more of your fabulous phone calls and the story behind the shade-tolerant delicious fruit known as the gooseberry. I'm Goosey Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit mosquito dunks and mosquito bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week about gooseberries, the plant that loves cool weather and produces fruit even when it doesn't get full sun. You'll want to hear all about it, and you will. It's coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Danielle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Danielle. How are you?
I'm good. And I am calling from Henry, Illinois.
Okay, where is Henry?
In central Illinois, by the Illinois River.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Danielle and Henry?
Well, last week we had an awful lot of rain, and trees and branches came down, and I have an apple tree that it's a semi-dwarf apple tree that's probably about 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
That is now at like a 40-degree angle,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure what the best thing to do to prop it back up is.
So are you getting apples from it?
A couple. Last year, it started producing last year, but I think the birds got them before we did. But
now,
yes, it is a little bit.
Are you pruning it every late winter, early spring, and thinning out the baby apples?
I've thinned out the baby apples already this year. We did not prune it last winter, but we did prune it the winter before that.
Okay, so that's not too bad. And how big is the tree at this point?
Probably about 12 feet tall.
Okay. And you say it's bending over at an angle. In other words, it's not straight upright anymore.
Right, because the ground is really soft over there anyway. I think we have something living underground making a lot of holes. And then
yeah.
I think that combined with the saturated ground, it just tipped right over.
More than likely, the ground might be holding water, but it would be unusual for an apple tree to be healthy in soil that didn't drain well. Does it flower nicely in the spring?
Not like a tremendous amount of flowers.
On your property, is the apple tree planted in an area that's elevated, or is it in a low spot?
A low spot.
How would you feel about moving this tree to a spot where it's going to flourish?
I'd be okay with that. If I could physically move it, I'm willing to.
With God and gardening, all things are possible. and it's never going to make you happy in the situation it's in right now. So I would advise you to do nothing over the next couple of months, which is always a good thing. You say you got a couple little apples out there. Let's see if we get any good eating off them. And then what I would have you do is find a spot that drains well, that's on high ground in your property. Apple trees and peach trees, everything like that. They want an area that gets a lot of sun, that gets morning sun. So what you want to do is pick out a new spot. Dig the new planting hole like now being August, September, October, and you really want to test it. Once you get a deep enough hole dug to try to accommodate most of the roots, you want to pour a bucket of water in there, and you want to watch, and that water has to disappear pretty quickly. If it just sits there for a couple of hours, the ground is too saturated for a fruit tree to do well. So dig the new hole now. Dig it wide but not deep. And then I guess the best time would be in the winter. It's going to be difficult. But, you know, winter, early spring, maybe even very late fall, you want to get a bunch of guys over. This is a two-case of beer job. And you want a big, heavy tarp. And you want to, like, six guys with shovels working out a couple of feet. And they're just going to keep digging and digging and digging and trying to pop up until they can get most of the roots out of the ground in a big island of soil. And then you want them to transfer this big honking tree over to the tarp, lug it over to the new spot, and then plant it in its new hole. Try to straighten it out as much as you can, but I wouldn't worry about a slight bend. Believe it or not, you get better fruit. You get more fruit on branches that are not going straight up, that are much more lateral.
Oh.
But I think the big situation here is it's planted in a wet spot. That's why it tipped over. That's why the ground feels spongy all the time. So you want to move it to a much drier area where it's going to be higher up. And you want to do this at some point after it loses its leaves in the fall. Over the winter would be ideal, but the ground may be frozen where you are. You want to, because apple trees bloom so early, you really want to do it in the late fall, get it in the ground and get settled so that it's been in the ground for a while and it's accommodated by the time springtime comes along. And as part of this intricate process, obviously you'll right it a little bit, and then after it blooms. We're not going to give it any more shocks. We're going to let it flower. And then after it produces its flowers, then you can prune it for the year. And as you prune it every season, you can gradually moderate the shape back to where you want it. The real problem is the spot it's in. I don't think it was a good spot for an apple tree.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Danielle.
Thanks. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Joanne, how are you today?
I am well, thank you, except I do have a cold that I'm recovering from, so
I can hear that. Are you sure it's a cold and not summer allergies?
Could be. Could be allergies.
Did you have a fever?
I didn't have a fever, so I guess it is allergies.
Yes. So where is grass allergic Joanne?
Well, I am calling about a house that is in West Berlin, New Jersey, that we are considering buying. It's a very nice little house, and the yard obviously has had some lawn care, like some artificial lawn care, and the grass is very uniform. It's very short, and, you know, it's all the same looking blade of grass.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same color. And the people had an above-ground pool, a little ground above-ground pool. That's a little area. They took that out last summer, so that looks pretty bleh where that was.
Right.
And so my concerns and questions are, if we buy this house, let's say, you know, we're under contract, and, you know, I don't know how this would happen, but if we then ask the homeowners to not use any lawn care, and then, you know, just say we move in a month later.
Right.
My biggest concern is we have two dogs. We have two kids, but they're older, and, you know, I don't expect them to
roll around in the grass as much. Yeah.
Or use it as a bathroom. You never know, but I don't think they will. but I'm chiefly concerned about my dog. So I'm wondering, you know, say we move in about a month later, and I guess this depends on how much rain and stuff we have, but I wonder, you know, how safe it will be for my dogs out there. And then my other question is, I'd like to gradually, you know, if we do buy this property, gradually return the yard to a natural state, more natural yard. I've had great success where we are now. I'm frankly not much of a gardener, Mike. I really don't like to do that much, but I very gradually added natives to our yard where we are now and have had tremendous success.
Okay.
You know, I like to plant them and sit back and let Mother Nature do her thing. And that's worked out really well. I have a beautiful lawn of like clover and ground cover and stuff that I never, ever water, even though we have really hot summers here. And so, you know, my question is, do you think that's a good approach? And, you know, or the pool area, would I have to do something in particular there? So those are my questions and concerns.
Okay, so you're about to make an offer on a house. You've made an offer on a house. I presume you're going to have the house inspected.
Yes, my husband and I are still in the talking stage.
Right. Well, before you buy any house, you always want to hire a house inspector, and you want to have the house inspected for problems. Tell the house inspector that you want to see their lawn care contract.
Okay.
Or to get from them what they have been using personally. And then you'll be able to look up those, especially herbicides, to see if they're the ones that have been implicated in the cancers in dogs. You're right about the rain. The more rain we get, the more this will be disseminated throughout the soil and go into our drinking water. But I think, you know, once you get serious, you would be certainly within your right to ask them not to apply any more treatments. Most of that stuff, quite honestly, is done in the spring anyway. Although if they have a service, the service is going to try to come and spray every week for something or other. But yes, you may have to play a waiting game depending on what they've used. But the honest answer on top of that is that's going to be the case with most homes in America, and you're just being more aware than most people who buy these things. So already you're aware. If you're put into a tough situation, it's a perfect house. There's no structural problems. The electrical and plumbing is good. The layout is good. And they have been using herbicides. It may sound stupid, but obviously you would limit the dog's outside time during the first 6 months to a year. And most importantly, when they came on, you would wash their feet.
Okay.
You would turn into the Pope for about 6 months. You'd be washing their feet, and that would remove so much of the hazard. As to returning the lawn, not doing too much to it and letting other plants move into it, I think that sounds like a great idea. And where the pool was, I would turn into a nice big planting bed where you can very specifically put native trees and shrubs, maybe a butterfly garden, something like that. So you're not trying to match up parts of the lawn and you don't have this blasted bomb site in the middle of everything.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
All right, good luck, Joanne.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Don't let geese eat your gooseberries. Alexis Landis, get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Claire in Lambertville, New Jersey writes, is it possible to grow gooseberries in my climate? Our yard is part full sun, part shade. How much room do these things need to grow? I'm picturing a little fruity paradise. Mike, I assume you called your friend Lee Reich about this.
Oh, yeah. He devoted an entire chapter to gooseberries in his earliest book, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, and they have a really nice entry in his newest book, Grow Fruit Naturally.
So can Claire grow gooseberries in New Jersey?
Almost certainly. They're a fruit of cooler climates and do best where summers are relatively mild, so she has a much better chance than someone down in Virginia. She'll just have to keep the plant's roots cool with mulch and keep them well watered when her summers get hot.
Full sun, part shade.
Well, she's in luck. Most fruits require a lot of sun, but gooseberries can take some shade. And the shrubs are fairly well behaved size-wise, ranging from around 3 to 5 feet in height and 5 feet in width. You just have to leave a lot of room around them and choose your varieties carefully, as their biggest problem is mildew. Unfortunately, Lee tells me that the absolute best-tasting varieties tend to be very prone to that disease. So you might have to settle for very good flavor.
What do gooseberries taste like? And how big is a gooseberry?
It's not nearly the size of a goose egg. Lee says that the different varieties can range in size from as small as a pea to almost as big as a small apple. But generally, you want small to medium. The really big ones tend not to be as flavorful. That flavor has been most often likened to that of a grape. But Lee says that some varieties will remind you of other fruits like plum and apricot. He adds that the best-tasting varieties are also very aromatic. And gooseberries come in almost every color, green, yellow, pink, purple.
So a lot of choices.
Oh, yeah. You definitely want to choose a disease-resistant variety, and you definitely want fruits with good flavor. Lee says that some of the cultivars taste pretty awful, while the best-tasting ones are ambrosial. And then there are the thorns to consider.
They have thorns?
There are thornless varieties, but Lee feels that they don't have the best flavor. In general, it seems the more intimidating the thorns, the better tasting the fruit. There are thornless varieties, but Lee feels that they don't have the best flavor. In general, it seems the more intimidating the thorns, the better tasting the fruit. One exception, he notes, is Captivator, quote, a nearly thornless variety with superb flavor.
And how much fruit are we talking about?
Lee says that a mature plant will produce a good 8 pounds of fruit a year, with some shrubs delivering 2 or 3 times that much.
Okay, now let's turn to some problems. Gisella in Edgar Springs, Missouri writes, I was so excited about all the fruits on our gooseberry bushes last year, but they all had worms in them. Would you please tell me what to use to get rid of them?
Lee says that that's the gooseberry fruit worm, which, like every pest with the word worm in its common name, is actually a caterpillar.
So BT is the answer, right?
Absolutely. A concentrated, naturally occurring soil organism that's sold under brand names like Dipel, Thoracide, and Greenstep. BT kills caterpillars that eat the sprayed parts of the plant, but is harmless to all other living things. It doesn't even affect adult butterflies. You have to be a hungry, hungry caterpillar to be harmed by BT. Just be sure to start spraying the plant a few weeks before these, quote, worms typically start tunneling into the fruit.
And finally, we heard from Broken-Hearted Bozina in Bristol, New Hampshire, who writes, I have had my gooseberry bush for at least 18 years. It flowers, gets pollinated by bees, starts to grow fruit, and then it all aborts in one fell swoop. Mike, could this be because she only has the one plant?
No, that's a good guess, but gooseberries are totally self-fruitful. You only need one plant. Now, Lee tried to pretend his phone wasn't working when I asked him this one, but I finally wrangled two possibilities out of him. One is a late frost. These plants pollinate very early in the season, and despite their legendary cold hardiness, a sudden late frost could cause the fruits to drop off while they were still very small. His other answer, which was actually his first answer, was one word: chipmunks. Lee has lost gooseberry fruit to those little cuties a lot, as well as to wild birds, his own chickens, and evil squirrels, which Lee seems to despise even more than I do.
Yikes, that's really saying something.
Well, he's a fruit grower, so he knows evil when it shakes its furry little tail. Anyway, if the fruit actually dropped off the tree early this year, it was a late frost. If the fruit disappeared, it was birds or evil animals. And if this happens every year, I suspect that the soil there is waterlogged and it's time to plant a gooseberry in a different spot. Well, that sure was an interesting look at gooseberries now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to what? I can't say goose my berries, that's for sure. Hey, Alexis, what are you going to do this week if I don't get out of the studio? Okay, that works. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And remember, if you do send us an email, please include your location. Please, please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Tricia Whiting. Our hired hand is Matt Hudecki. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll goose on back to see you again next week. Although you can use it to scrub pots and pans, few gardeners sing the praises of the weed known as horsetail. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at this ancient and unusual plant. Plus your fabulous phone calls.